Good morning, everybody.
Pass this around.
You go ahead and turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 13. Continue our study there. Since I am very much keen on giving you guys confidences that I am well-researched in my teaching, I did want to read an article to you that is just a sampling of some of my research. It's from a website called psychcentral.com, so ought to be super helpful to you, I believe. It's entitled The Psychology of Love, and I want to read this article. It's very brief, but I want to read it because it is just another example of what is being put forward routinely, not just in sort of a secular society or being consumed by secular minds, but you even find these kinds of, at least semblances of these kinds of understandings or definitions about the nature of love, the manifestation of love, the origin of love. You find this sort of seeping into just the consciousness of people in general. And I want to read it to once again provide for us what is a stark contrast between what you find here and what we obviously are looking at in 1 Corinthians chapter 13, and then there's some tie-ins to our particular focus this morning. Again, the title of the article is The Psychology of Love. It begins by saying, love has fascinated researchers for decades. We look at what experts have learned about the origins and psychology of love in this article. Love is a powerful, complex, emotional experience that involves change in your body chemistry, including your neurotransmitters. It impacts your social relationships in varied ways, affecting how you relate to others around you. So there again is the fundamental presupposition, the operational presupposition of love being primarily an emotion, and even going so far as to cast it into the arena of chemical reaction. And we talk about this kind of thing. Two people have chemistry. Well, now modern science, if you will, and materialistic worldview would even go to brain science, brain chemicals, and the nature of love being having an effect on that chemistry. There are many types, like the love you share with your partner, family, and friends. And each version you feel is unique. So again, it's a feeling. It can fill you with emotions ranging from joy to heartbreak. What is love? Love is an emotion of strong affection, tenderness, or devotion towards a subject or object. When you love a person, you experience pleasurable sensations in their presence and are sensitive about their reactions to you. Now, I ask you, is that really true all the time? Anybody want to talk about maybe something that happened before you came to church today, married couples? Anyone? I want to ask all of you that did you feel or experience pleasurable sensations in the presence of your spouse? And were you sensitive about their reactions to you just because that's what love is? No one? Okay. Research from 2016 points to neuropeptides and neurotransmitters as the source of love. So in case you were wondering, there it is. Feelings of love help us form social bonds with others. As social creatures, these natural chemicals developed to help us survive by encouraging mutual support, reproduction, and cooperation. So there is your Darwinistic sort of idea, sort of a survival of the fittest, and love fits into that rubric. After all, love promotes sort of these bonds with others for our mutual survival. Support, reproduction, cooperation, fending off T-Rex, I'm not sure what else. It seems like so much more, though. Isn't that interesting? This is the conclusion now after that. It seems like so much more, doesn't it? Calling love an interaction of brain chemicals doesn't quite describe how it can warm your heart and captivate your soul. So the psychology of love. Attachment is a component of love. Strong attachment bonds set mammals apart from many other types of animals, though other groups, including fish and birds, also form strong social connections to help them survive. A 2017 review describes four types of mammalian attachment bonds as pair bonds, where individuals form a close long-term social connection, bonds between parents and their infants, bonds between peers, conspecific bonds, or bonds between individuals of the same species. Most instances of human love fall into one of these categories. For example, the love you feel for a close friend could be classified as a peer bond. So you can, if you want to get scientific, start calling your friends, hey, I have a peer bond relationship with you. I'm really happy about that. A romantic relationship is a type of pair bond. It can start as mutual attraction and evolve into love over time. Which, by the way, I'm not even sure if we know what love is at this point, other than the chemical description, neurotransmitter description. When you like someone, you enjoy their companionship and care about their well-being. When you love them, those feelings are unconditional. It goes on to talk about the physical effects of love. Love can do more than help you bond with another person. It can even impact your physical health. Love may affect your immune system. A 2019 study found that falling in love resulted in immune system changes similar to protective viral infection responses. So now love is a virus. It might also safeguard against cancer, according to a 2021 study that found tissue from, now get this, here's the conclusion that love may safeguard against cancer because, according to a 2021 study that found tissue from pair-bonded mice was less likely to grow tumors than tissue from mice with disruptions to their pair bonds. That's the conclusion. Now, obviously, there are known physiological benefits to flourishing and loving human relationships. I mean, we know that. But that conclusion about cancer seems awfully specific and a pretty large leap from fewer tumors in bonded mice. But anyway, can you control whether you fall in love? Here's the next question. Can you control whether you fall in love? The heart wants what the heart wants, right? You might feel like you have no control over the love you feel, but research says otherwise. I love that when that's thrown down. Research says otherwise. Just generally, research. Research says otherwise. Love is like an emotion that you can regulate. Okay, so this is hopeful. You can regulate by generating new feelings or changing the intensity of the feelings you have. Now, here are some emotional regulation strategies. If you need to sort of control whether or not you love someone, because this particular relationship is not healthy for me, and so I have this strong affection or attraction that certainly is love, and so I need to control that. I need to regulate that is the idea. So here's some emotional regulation strategies. The first one is called situation selection. Avoiding or seeking situations based on how they make you feel. Try that on in the life of the church. We'd never talk to each other at all. Distraction, engaging in another activity to reduce the strength of your feelings. Expression suppression, hiding how you feel. Cognitive reappraisal, changing your thoughts so that your feelings can change. So this is just sort of mental gymnastics. It's avoiding difficult situations. It's actually making decisions about social interactions exclusively based upon how they make you feel, good or bad. These are the emotional regulation strategies. So if you're disappointed because the love you feel isn't reciprocated, you may be able to take your mind off of it, it says. It goes on to describe different types of love, the seven kinds of love. In Sternberg's triangular theory, cover a range of relationship types. Liking, you share emotional intimacy, but there's no physical passion or commitment. Friendship falls into this category. Infatuation, passion is the key component of infatuation. If you're physically attracted to another person, but haven't developed emotional intimacy or established a commitment, this is infatuation. Empty, this is a category of love, according to this one researcher. Empty love. What Sternberg calls empty love is a committed relationship that lacks passion or intimacy. Examples include an arranged marriage or a previously emotional or physical relationship that's lost its spark. How many marriages have sadly dissolved because the spark is gone? There's romantic love, companionate love, fatuous love, being swept away by passion into an engagement or marriage without emotional intimacy. And then consummate love is the last one. Consummate love is the goal for many when they envision marriage or a spousal partnership. This kind of love includes commitment, passion, and emotional intimacy. So there's this ultimate kind of love, but it's just one of seven categories or types of love. It's called consummate love. And then I love the conclusion of this article. It says, let's recap. I'm going to boil it down for you. Love comes in many forms. You can love more than one person simultaneously in different ways. Emotional intimacy is present in many relationships, but not all. The same is true for passion and commitment. Attachment is another relationship element that may be present in love. Positive attachments are emotionally supportive and provide you with a feeling of security. Now, I say all this, and obviously I had my sort of tones of derision kind of littered through my little commentary here. But really, when I read this and I reflect on it for just a moment, I become very sad. It's a very sad reality to sort of be reminded of how vacuous our understandings and definitions and accepted, like informed and researched definitions of love that people are trying to figure out how to operate according to and how to navigate in their own relationships and how to avoid and re-engage and live sane, healthy lives in social contacts with other people. It's when I read this, if I try to imagine these kinds of ideas running through my mind as an unbeliever who does not have access nor understanding of objective divine truth to guide me, to guard me, to inform my thinking, this would leave me utterly adrift, with no real sense of how to understand what I'm to do in these relationships, particularly in relationships with people that are strained in some way, that are difficult, that are challenging. And so we have in our culture and in cultures over and over again where this kind of sort of lack of clarity around what love actually is and what love actually does more pointedly, you have unstable at best and utterly decimated social relationships at worst that run through a culture. And the impact is devastating. And as we spoke of last time we were together, I mean, this has far-reaching implications for us societally, culturally. But it certainly has impact on us as a local body of believers. It should, I think, one of the things it should do is it should impress upon us the need for us as God's people to be a very clear, unmixed beacon of love, an example of love, of eternal, God-centered, Spirit-enabled and empowered love so that people see that and are drawn to it. How devastating and sad for any local fellowship or for any individual believer to not be genuinely and consistently manifesting the kind of love that we are called to manifest and that the Spirit places within us, knowing that the absence of that kind of testimony is leaving a dark void for people who are lost and adrift and don't know what love is. And they're consuming these kinds of ideas about love. Well, obviously, as we turn to our chapter in 1 Corinthians chapter 13, we are given something that is so vastly different, of course, and so profound and so clear. And so I want to turn our attention back to that. And I'm just going to read verses 1 through 7 today. The Apostle Paul says, "If I speak in the tongues of men and of angels, but have not love, I am a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. And if I have prophetic powers and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have all faith so as to remove mountains, but have not love, I am nothing. If I give away all I have, and if I deliver up my body to be burned, but have not love, I gain nothing. Love is patient and kind. Love does not envy or boast. It is not arrogant or rude. It does not insist on its own way. It is not irritable or resentful. It does not rejoice at wrongdoing, but rejoices with the truth. Love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things." We've been walking through this chapter, and particularly more recently, in recent weeks, we've been focusing our attention on verses 4 through 7. But as we've been looking at this chapter, we've broken it down into basically three outline points. The diminishing effects of love's absence, we see that in verses 1 through 3. Where love is absent, it just vacates impact. It vacates substance. Speech, profound speech, eloquent speech, the tongues of men and of angels without love is just noise. It's distracting. Having power, being an impressive person, being able to demonstrate power and importance without love reduces the person to nothing. And then being one who's willing to sacrifice even their very life, certainly their possessions, but even their very life, to give of themselves in such a way has no return. There is no gain, it says. So there's this diminishing effect of love's absence. And then verses 4 through 7, we begin to look at the active evidences of love's presence. And so you have this series of two positive aspects of love, or two things that love does from a positive perspective. And then you have eight sort of negative actions of love to give us a sense of what the positive should look like. When love is present, it looks like this. It does these things. It is long-suffering in its patience, and it extends kindness, but it doesn't do these other things. It doesn't envy. It's not arrogant. It's not self-seeking. It's not prone to anger. It's not easily provoked, these kinds of things. So that we understand from the opposite description what love actually is, or what happens when we're actively working out love. But then we come to this last point, the incomparable value of love's endurance, and this is picked up in verses 8 through 13. The incomparable value of love's endurance. But we find, before we get to that final section where the Apostle Paul begins to speak of all these things that are going to pass away, these gifts that are temporal, that are going to pass away, and yet in the midst of all that, love is the thing that endures and has this incomparable value. He gives us this characteristic, this final characteristic of love in verse 7. And I just simply summarize it this way. The entirety of verse 7, I simply summarize it this way. Love faithfully endures, very simply. Love faithfully endures. In the ESV, the way the Apostle Paul describes it is that love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. And these are certainly four distinct verbs that we're going to look at individually. But what they really do is they describe several key facets of the faithful and enduring nature of love. And they're all, you'll notice, they're all sort of rhetorically linked together with the same modifier, all. The ESV translates it all things, but it's just one word. It's an adjectival modifier. It just means all. So literally, you could say that the text is saying love bears all, believes all, hopes all, endures all. So this one verse connects all these verbs with this single adjectival modifier to sort of produce what is this comprehensive characteristic or action of love, in that it endures faithfully, or it faithfully endures. You can see how Paul here is sort of transitioning his flow of thought into this final section that begins in verse 8, the section that, as I said, we're just calling the incomparable value of love's endurance. But here in verse 7, he's describing this faithful endurance. He's not speaking of necessarily its incomparable value compared to other things, but he's just describing it. In verse 8, he puts this exclamation point on it by simply saying, love never ends. And he transitions into this next section. The fact that love endures in this way, that it is faithful in its endurance, this is the characteristic that ends up producing its incomparable value that we'll look at, just begin to look at next time. So let's look more closely then at the various aspects of love's faithful endurance that Paul gives us here in verse 7. And first, just as a point of clarification in the text, as I said, each one of these verbs in the text is modified by an adjective. Pass is the adjective. It just means all. And translated, as I said, in the ESV, all things. And this obviously should not be understood to mean everything. That's not the correct interpretation or understanding of all things or all. In other words, it's not saying love bears everything, love believes everything, love hopes everything, and love endures everything. And this would certainly be a nonsensical interpretation, basically internally contradictory. You can't bear everything and believe everything and hope everything and endure everything. That's impossible. That's an impossibility. But not only that, it would directly contradict much of what he's already said about the nature of love. I mean, there are things that love does not endure. In other words, love does not rejoice in wrongdoing. Never rejoices in wrongdoing. So this is not a statement of love's sort of simplistic acceptance of everything. It is really this repeated use of this adjective all here is to emphasize its steadfastness, its consistency, its durability. It's a steadfastness and a consistency and a durability that's active in current circumstances, and it's even assured in future circumstances, whatever they may be. That's the idea. This all is a statement of love's steadfastness, its faithfulness, its durability in all circumstances. Gordon Fee says it this way: love has a tenacity in the present, buoyed by its absolute confidence in the future, that enables one to live in every kind of circumstance and continually to pour oneself out in behalf of others. End quote. That's what this reference is of bearing all things, believing all things, hoping all things, enduring all things. Some translators even opt for the word always as opposed to all things. The NIV, for example, says it always protects, it always trusts, it always hopes, it always perseveres. But again, the thrust of the meaning here is that it's this idea of unwavering faithfulness, come what may. That's fundamental to the nature of love. And obviously, it's another stark contrast to sort of secular notions of love. It is steadfastly resolute, not whimsical, not momentary. Love is unmoved by ever-changing circumstances. It's not inclined toward fluctuations of situational passion and emotion. This is what the article that I read totally describes. Your circumstances or your situation that stimulates these emotions or these passions are determinative of some category or form of love. The Apostle Paul is having none of that. It's unmoved by circumstances. Doesn't fluctuate based upon situational passion or emotion. It's resolute. So let's look at some of the facets that he gives us here of this faithful endurance of love. He first of all says that love bears all things. Love bears all things. Stego is the verb. And there are two primary definitions of this verb. One is to keep confidential, to cover, or to pass over in silence. And then the other one is more familiar to how the ESV translates it, to bear up against difficulties, to bear, to stand, to endure. So you have these two different sort of nuances to the same verb. The first definition really is what informed the NIV translators, as I've already quoted, because it says that love always protects. It doesn't say love bears all things. It says always protects. It has this idea of keeping confidential, of covering, of passing over in silence. You might say protecting someone's dignity. You know of some delicate situation, or you know of some sin or some failure or some difficulty, you know, family dynamic or whatever, and love doesn't broadcast that to bring shame or embarrassment or a sense of anxiety to a fellow believer. Love covers those things. Love conceals those things. Love protects the other. That's the idea. But we only see this verb, interestingly enough, we only see it used three other times, and only by the Apostle Paul. Three other times in the New Testament. It's the only place you find it. You find it in 1 Corinthians chapter 9. So in the same letter, in chapter 9, verse 12, it says this: if others share this rightful claim on you, do not we even more? Nevertheless, we have not made use of this right, but we endure, here's the word, we endure anything rather than put an obstacle in the way of the gospel of Christ. Now, in this context, in 1 Corinthians chapter 9, the Apostle Paul is speaking about giving up his right to compensation by the Corinthians for his work of ministry among them. He gladly set that aside because he is willing to endure, to bear up against difficulties in order to advance the spread of the gospel. That's the idea of the usage there. And then the other two times that he uses it are found in 1 Thessalonians chapter 3, starting in verse 1 and then again in verse 5. But he says in verse 1, therefore, when we could bear it no longer, we were willing to be left behind at Athens alone. And we sent Timothy, our brother and God's co-worker in the gospel of Christ, to establish and exhort you in the faith. For this reason, he says in verse 5, when I could bear it no longer, there's the word again, I sent to learn about your faith for fear that somehow the tempter had tempted you and our labor would be in vain. So in this instance, the word is used to describe what is really Paul's grave concern about fellow believers and the steadfastness of their faithfulness in the midst of affliction and deception. And so he was so eager about wanting to know how they were doing. He just couldn't bear not knowing anymore. That's the idea. So he sends Timothy, both to encourage and exhort them, but also to get word back to him of how they're doing. And then he rejoices once he hears back that they're doing quite well. But that's the idea. He couldn't bear. He couldn't endure the state of not knowing how these dear brothers and sisters were doing under the current state of affliction and persecution and even deceptive teaching. So you have these uses by the Apostle Paul that all sort of have to do with enduring or bearing up under or not being able to bear up under certain circumstances. That's the idea. So it could carry both ideas, this idea of covering, protecting, but also doing that with an endurance or a bearing up on behalf of someone else. This is kind of the way that I think John MacArthur is seeking to define the term in his commentary. He kind of brings both of these definitions together, this idea of covering, protecting, along with bearing up or enduring. He says, stego, to bear, basically means to cover or to support and therefore to protect. Love bears all things by protecting others from exposure, ridicule, or harm. Genuine love does not gossip or listen to gossip. Even when a sin is certain, love tries to correct it with the least possible hurt and harm to the guilty person. Love never protects sin, but is anxious to protect the sinner. So that's one possible way to kind of understand the application of this love that bears all things. It's interesting to think about this in light of sort of the natural ebb and flow of ministry within the life of our congregation. It's not uncommon that someone might come to, and this might have happened to you as well, but someone might come to one of the elders and say, are you aware of such and such going on with such and such? I was having this conversation and there's this point of concern, or there's a certain struggle, a certain trial that's really heavy and really sort of intense and difficult. And so there's this question as to whether or not, you know, an elder or the elders are kind of aware that there's a fellow believer among us that's going through something particularly pronounced in its difficulty or its impact. And it's not always the case, but it's frequently the case that there is an elder somewhere in the periphery, or at least, or even directly involved in the situation in some way, and is aware of it. But the fact that no one really knows that is kind of the character of this kind of love. That it's not so much that you're trying to you're just not gossiping. It's that there's a certain sense that love is motivated to protect one another, even from misunderstandings about something that they may be going through. There is this desire to sort of bear up under even the struggle with them and the burden-bearing process, and to cover and protect and to make sure that that's not a subject of, you know, water cooler talk or you know, sort of undisciplined conversation, even if it's motivated by genuine concern by others. It's the idea of protecting but also enduring in this effort. And remember, this is describing love that is action toward others. So the Apostle Paul is describing a characteristic of love's enduring faithfulness, in that it bears all things, it protects and bears up with people, with others. It's the focus is outward, it's toward others. It's not just sort of this internal resolve to endure hardship. It's enduring struggle with others in one way or another. Several passages of Scripture sort of provide some color to this. Proverbs chapter 10, verse 12 says, hatred stirs up strife, but love covers all offenses. So in the wisdom of Proverbs, you have these two sort of contrasts set side by side. You have hatred, and what hatred does is it stirs up strife. It's this idea of actively seeking to bring greater hardship to others by stirring things up. Whereas love does quite the opposite. It covers all offenses. It protects. James chapter 5, verses 19 to 20 says, my brothers, if anyone among you wanders from the truth and someone brings him back, let him know that whoever brings back a sinner from his wandering will save his soul from death and will cover a multitude of sins. So again, you have this example of someone loving another enough who is wandering to bring them back. And in so doing, you're providing cover for them. There's a covering and protective aspect to this kind of love. And bearing this burden of seeking to gather someone who's wandering and bring him back into the fold. And of course, we have the example of Peter, 1 Peter chapter 4. He says, above all, keep loving one another earnestly. What does that look like? Well, love covers a multitude of sins. That love has this character about it. It seeks to cover and protect, not expose, not stir up, not cultivate undignified chatter about the struggles or failings of a fellow believer. Love bears all these things. And secondly, love believes all things, he says. This is really just a description of the fact that love is not predisposed to suspicion or cynicism or a general distrust of fellow believers. The kind of suspicion or cynicism or distrust that would compel you or me to kind of keep people at arm's length, right? That's what you do with people you don't trust, or that's what you do if you're just sort of generally composed of an attitude of cynicism or distrust. You know, people can't be trusted. You know, you can't trust people. If that's sort of like an operating, even an unconscious mindset, well, the natural sort of relational impact of that is you keep people at arm's length. And the Apostle Paul is calling us to something very different than that. Avoiding this predisposition towards suspicion, love, on the other hand, willingly, intentionally, and steadfastly believes the best in other believers. It believes the best in them, even when they stumble. Even when they stumble. Galatians 6 cautions us, when someone stumbles, those who are mature, lift them up, but take heed, lest you fall. There's this caution there that even if someone is stumbling, you're loving them in such a way that you're believing the best in them. You're counting on them to repent and be restored. You're not characterized by a suspicion that would say, all right, I see this brother or the sister, and they've stumbled and they've fallen, and I'm going to try to, you know, bring them back around, but I don't know, it doesn't look good. I have my doubts. It's a very easy mindset for us to slip into, particularly with those who might be struggling in a persistent kind of way. The Apostle Paul would call us to a different sort of attitudinal disposition about our fellow brothers and sisters in Christ. We believe all things. We're not inclined toward just suspicion or cynicism about them maturing in the faith or them walking in godliness or them being a faithful brother and sister to us when we are in need. We don't keep people at arm's length because we just don't trust people. We just don't think we can count on them. We believe all things. This phenomenal example for us in John chapter 21, speaking of Peter again, after Peter had denied Christ at the crucifixion, at the time of the crucifixion, at this seminal moment, culminating moment, Peter, the bold one, the brash one, the strong one, cowered in weakness and fear and denied his Lord. Three times. And Jesus comes to him in John 21 with those powerful, loving words. Do you love me? Then feed my sheep. Feed my lambs. And restored him. That's believing all things. Jesus himself spent 3 years with these men, made himself known to them, both in his comprehensive and consummate perfection in living out the law in all of its characteristics of godliness and kindness and compassion and truth and faithfulness, as well as revealing to them, and Peter in particular, who was one of the disciples who went to him to that mountain and saw his unveiled glory for that moment. So Peter had this experience, saw him do all of his miracles, and had this experience with this God-man, whom he himself said, when asked, "Who do you say that I am?" "You're the Christ, the Son of the living God." And then he denies him three times, shortly before he's hanging on a cross. And Jesus responds with full restoration. That's believing all things. John Calvin says this: "Love believeth all things. Not that the Christian knowingly and willingly allows himself to be imposed upon, not that he divests himself of prudence and judgment, that he may be the more easily taken advantage of, not that he unlearns the way of distinguishing black from white. What then? He requires here, as I have already said, simplicity and kindness in judging of things. And he declares that these are the invariable accomplishments of love. The consequence will be that a Christian man will reckon it better to be imposed upon by his own kindness and easy temper than to wrong his brother by an unfriendly suspicion." End quote. Love believes all things. And then finally, love hopes all things. This firmly roots our love in God Himself. Love hopes all things. It roots our love in God, in His character, in His promises, and in what He says is true. It roots our love there. Our love for other people. This love that hopes all things is a love that's rooted in God. Again, looking at Peter, who learned this so well in visceral kinds of ways. Listen to what he says in 1 Peter chapter 1, starting in verse 3. "Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. According to His great mercy, He has caused us to be born again to a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead, to an inheritance that is imperishable, undefiled, and unfading, kept in heaven for you, who by God's power are being guarded through faith for a salvation ready to be revealed in the last time." Down in verse 13, "Therefore, preparing your minds for action and being sober-minded, set your hope fully on the grace that will be brought to you at the revelation of Jesus Christ." And then down in verse 22, "Having purified your souls by your obedience to the truth for a sincere brotherly love, love one another earnestly from a pure heart. Since you have been born again, not of perishable seed, but of imperishable, through the living and abiding Word of God." Peter opens his first letter by speaking of this wonderful salvation that is rooted in hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ. And then he calls believers to be sober-minded and to set their hope fully upon the grace that will be revealed in the last time. And then he calls them to action, which begins with a purified soul, an obedience to the truth that works itself out in brotherly love, loving one another earnestly from a pure heart. Love hopes all things. Love that we extend to one another is rooted not in our hope that they somehow produce for us. Our capacity to love like the Spirit loves is not contingent upon or dependent upon some hope that we've placed in the goodness or the kind intentions or the future faithfulness of the believers that we're called to love. This love is rooted in God and in His character and in His purposes and in His promises and in His truth. The Pillar New Testament commentary says this: "This is not about hoping for the best in those around us. It is about maintaining the hope set before us by the one to whom we have entrusted our lives and our futures, and being empowered by that eschatological hope for our future to take the risk of loving those around us in the present. If our love was somehow contingent upon a hope that we've placed in those to whom we are called to love, we would not be characteristically loving. The people around us disappoint us. And if they're not disappointing us, you're disappointing them, right? We disappoint one another. But if the love that we manifest to one another is rooted in an eschatological hope, an eternal hope, that God is true, His promises are secure, His word is powerful and authoritative, then we love freely in that hope, unreservedly in that kind of hope. Kind of love is rooted in this kind of eternal hope, always endures, always perseveres, always remains. To maintain a belief or course of action in the face of opposition, to stand one's ground, to hold out, to endure. That's the word here at the end, that love always endures. Faithfully, steadfastly, unwaveringly. As he goes on to say, and as we'll begin to look at next time, love never ends. True love is unfailing and unending. It is not characterized by whimsy or passion or emotion or self-gratification. It is rooted in our salvation and our hope in Jesus Christ and the eternal hope that we have in God and in His work of righteousness and justice in the world. And we love with a consummate bearing up and protecting of others. We love believing the best in others. We love hoping all things for others. And we have a love that actually endures. Let's pray.